Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on the latest data for oral selective estrogen receptor degraders, or SERDs, to treat metastatic breast cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent online activity, Drs. Virginia Kaklamani, Kamal Abu-Hussein, Javier Cortez, and Seth Wander will discuss the potentially practice-changing SERDs data from ASCO 2026. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Stemline Therapeutics, Inc. In the first segment, Dr. Wander will review SERENA-6 data, including updates presented at ASCO 2026.
A lot of exciting data to review. Looking forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on these trials. So we're going to give an update for a couple of minutes on some of the results, including progression-free survival from SERENA-6. This was presented by our friend Francois Bedard at ASCO a couple of days ago. Here's the schema for the study. Remember, in SERENA-6, these were patients on first-line AI with a CDK inhibitor in the metastatic setting for hormone receptor-positive, HER2-negative disease. They were monitored every 2 to 3 months, and if they had a new ESR1 mutation without clinical or radiographic progression, they were then randomized to either continue the AI with the same CDK until radiographic progression per standard of care, or make an early switch to camizestrant while continuing the same CDK inhibitor. This was a prospective, placebo-controlled, double-blind study. The primary endpoint was what we're calling PFS1, which is the time to progression radiographically after randomization. We're going to look at here is PFS2, which includes that PFS1 plus whatever happens on the next line of therapy via conventional imaging. And just to level set here, this is the original publication from last year. This was the initial disclosure showing a PFS1 benefit from about 9 to 16 months with a hazard ratio around 0.4 to 0.5, highly significant. We also saw this impressive change in quality of life, where the time to deterioration in quality of life in this prospective double-blind study was about 6 months in the control arm, up to 23-plus months in the intervention arm. Here's the updated data from ASCO looking at PFS1. No major changes here from about 9 to 17 months. Hazard ratio still below 0.5. Now we have a median follow-up of almost 2 years. And then here's the subsequent therapy. Now, one of the big areas of controversy, and I'm sure, Virginia, everyone's going to have strong opinions about this in a minute when we get to our panel discussion. This has been a hot topic of debate after the recent FDA ODAC. Is the PFS2 and the fact that only a minority of patients, particularly on the control arm, received a next generation oral SERD in the next line of therapy. And the whole concept here is that early deployment of the oral SERD has meaningful clinical impact. Now, what you can see here, and they're breaking this down by what patients received after progression on the study, you can see in the control arm about 50% of patients got some sort of novel endocrine or SERD plus targeted therapy. But the asterisk here is that the vast majority were still fulvestrant. Only, as you can see, about 12 to 13% on the control arm got a next generation anti-estrogen or oral SERD. So I think my own opinion, we'll see what everyone else thinks, I'm not sure that you can lump the fulvestrant in here with the oral SERD, because the whole point is that these drugs have particular activity in the ESR1 mutant subpopulation. And again, here we have only a small number of patients getting oral SERD-based therapy in the second line. You can see there was a fair amount of cytotoxic therapy given in both arms, including ADCs and chemo. With that in mind, here is the updated PFS2, and this did now reach statistical significance, and we saw this at ASCO. We have an improvement in PFS2 from 19 months in the control arm up to almost 26 months in the arm that made the early switch to camizestrant. Hazard ratio here just over 0.6, and you can see the p-value. Here's the updated overall survival data. This is entirely immature. I mean, you can see there's only a difference in 3 events between the two arms. So the hazard ratio is 0.9 crossing 1. And they comment here that there, as we have data cutoffs moving forward in time, perhaps the hazard ratio is getting a little bit better, but still very, very early. Now, here's really interesting data that we saw at San Antonio, and Virginia knows I love this kind of data here. This is what makes me very excited on the biomarker front. So this is looking at the allelic fraction of ESR1 on treatment. So double-blind, placebo-controlled, after 2 to 3 cycles of treatment, what happens to the allelic fraction in the blood of the ESR1? And you can see on the control arm, if you don't address it, if you stay on an AI over the next 2 to 3 cycles, on average, the variant allele fraction increases by almost 70%. That resistance mutation is there, and it's kind of plodding along, and it's increasing in frequency. But in the patients who make the early switch to camizestrant, we have a median decrease of 100%. Most of the patients cleared their ESR1, with a few exceptions, as you can see here. And what they showed us at ASCO was also very interesting. Here, you're looking at total circulating tumor DNA, not just ESR1. Now, this is Guardant 360 in the metastatic setting, not Guardant Reveal. This is not MRD. So this is a less sensitive test, but they're showing us at week 4, so after 1 cycle, and week 8, after 2 cycles, the total amount of ctDNA is dropping significantly in the patients who get the camizestrant. So not only is the ESR1 allelic fraction going down, but the total burden of ctDNA is going down. Median change, again, 94 to 99%. And it's going up, and you can see over time it's going up in the control arm, 16% up, and then another month, 64% up. So over time, the total burden of ctDNA and the total burden of ESR1 is rising in the control arm. Now here they show that over 50% of patients in the intervention arm clear their ctDNA over these first couple of cycles, and they do an exploratory analysis. In the patients who clear ctDNA, there's actually a significant association with overall survival, with a hazard ratio of 0.4. Now, this is a subgroup of a subgroup, right? This is not the primary endpoint of overall survival, but it's saying in those patients who make the change and clear not just the ESR1, but all of their circulating tumor DNA, that there is an association potentially with overall survival, which I think is interesting and is worth us discussing here. So these are my comments, not from Dr. Bedard or Dr. Turner. These are my thoughts on this data. So with additional follow-up, the PFS1 is consistent improvement of about 7+ months with a hazard ratio around 0.4 to 0.5. PFS2 has now reached statistical significance with a median improvement of about 6 to 7 months, but only a minority of patients on the control arm received an oral SERD or a next-gen antiestrogen, less than 13%. Debate continues regarding the relevance of this particular metric, and the FDA, after that ODAC meeting, has given more time to make their final deliberations here. So we don't yet have a decision, approved or not approved, from the FDA. Overall survival, very immature, 46 versus 49 events, so we can't say anything. But there is a marked decrease in ESR1 allelic fraction and ctDNA clearance improvement with the camizestrant switch. So we just heard from Javier about the negative Persevera study. We're waiting for SERENA-4. My question here is, will potential frontline deployment, if SERENA-4 is positive, make this kind of obsolete, right? Or are we still looking at a dynamic ctDNA-based switch, or maybe only second-line use of these agents? And if this does get approved, which it might in the near future, how are we going to pursue this testing in clinic? What are the practical barriers and the way that we're going to deploy this? And then how will broader integration of adjuvant CDK and potential adjuvant oral SERD with Lidera impact resistance and the use of these drugs in what I'm going to call the new frontline metastatic setting, which starts to look like the old second-line metastatic setting, given more CDK use, more extended antiestrogen use, and potentially oral SERD use in the adjuvant setting. So it's going to keep us busy for a while here.
In the next segment, the panel will discuss some potential implications of the latest SERENA-6 findings.
So let's move on to SERENA-6 and let's debate what we're going to do. The regimen was approved by European agencies, right, Javier? The regimen's already approved for the past 6 months or so in the UAE, but it's questionable as to whether we're going to be using this approach here. So Javier, what are your thoughts about SERENA-6 in 1.5 minutes?
Well, two quick comments. The first one is that, in my opinion, SERENA-6 wanted to answer two questions in one trial, and this always not very good. It tried to answer if CAMI is superior to aromatase inhibitor, and it is. but it wanted to answer, or maybe we wanted to have the answer about if changing before is better than changing afterwards. So it is not answered. And I love the presentation that was done. In my opinion, SENA6 is important because the quality of life is clearly better. So if we prolong progression-free survival 1, which at the end is the patient continues to be better, I think that for not all patients, but there certainly there are a group of patients, maybe with who are not doing so well, maybe the tumor markers are going a little bit worse, or maybe some pain or something, the patient is not doing absolutely normal life, that SENA6 could help these patients try to change the treatment before.
So not doing it on everybody, but selectively doing it on patients that you're realizing maybe symptomatically that they're having some microprogression.
Agree.
Kamil, what's your thought about SERENA 6? Let's say the FDA approves it tomorrow. How are you going to use it here?
I actually thought that SERENA 6, definitely besides the significant improvement that we've seen in quality of life deterioration and improvement in functional and social well-being and pain and shortness of breath, which are all very important and meaningful endpoints, I thought it took a very middle approach between trials like Persevera and Serena 4, where we are treating everyone from the get-go with an oral SERD. And we know that eventually only up to 40% of those patients are going to develop the ESR1 mutation. So we're exposing an additional 60% with no clear answer in our minds as to whether they will eventually need that or not, versus the other extreme, which is what we're doing in practice right now, which is treating patients until there is radiographic progression. And then the ones who have an ESR1 mutation are being switched to an oral SERD. So I think SERENA 6 took a very smart approach where they detected early on at the time of development, at the time where we expect there is a meaningful period where we can approach the patient and hopefully work on this microscopic disease or molecular progression that is happening before it shows itself in the form of a radiographic progression. So I'm extremely in favor of that approach.
Okay, perfect. Seth, two questions for you. Number one, you mentioned that OS might be immature. Obviously, there's a very small difference in events, but we have a kind of a long-ish follow-up. So would you ever expect to see an overall survival benefit? That's number one. And number two, there's more chemotherapy that was given in the camizestrant arm, 43% versus 30. So wouldn't that also influence PFS2?
Yeah, thanks. And I think the broader point here that you're bringing up is it's a little tough to deconvolute PFS2 in the study based on the way it was done. And I'm of two minds about this, and I think you can argue it both ways. On the one hand, forcing clinicians to choose an oral SERD or an oral SERD based regimen in the PFS2 or the second line here would have maybe negatively hurt accrual, because there are other roads to go down, PI3K pathway inhibitors, some people need ADCs, et cetera. On the other hand, having an international study where most people can't access it and not at least bucketing clinicians into, I think, two or three choices to increase a subset of patients to get the oral SERDs, I think did limit our ability to conclude, to Javier's point, about that second element of going early versus going late. To answer your first question, I don't expect a survival benefit here. It's a relatively small number of patients. There are many different roads to take via second, third, fourth line therapy. We have other targeted agents. We have obviously all the ADCs. To your point, there's a disproportionate amount of chemotherapy use, you know, between the two arms. I'm not terribly surprised that there's a little bit more chemo in that you know, camizestrant arm, but then again, it was a double blind study, so not everybody knew, you know, that they got the oral SERD. I think to see a survival benefit in that first to second line ER positive metastatic setting, we would expect to need a much bigger study and a much longer period of time. I think that ctDNA analysis is sort of an interesting way to try to get at this, to show that at least in a subset of patients that there's either a significantly positive or significantly negative overall survival outcome, but that's not the primary or even the secondary endpoint. It's an exploratory post hoc, you know, subgroup analysis. So we don't want to overcall the impact of that. I think this really hinges on, to the points that my colleagues brought up here, the philosophy of the doctor, the philosophy of the patient, and how much you buy into the original trial design with the primary endpoint of PFS1. Javier's point about persevERA is very, very well taken. The curves split right where you expect them to, right where the ESR1s begin to emerge, which to me sort of supports the notion, to Kamal's point, about integrating the SERD in that subset of patients early before they develop significant symptom burden and other problems. Is SERENA-6 the best way to do that cost-wise and logistically? Is it like a switch study for all comers, but then you're still kind of wasting it on 50 to 60%? I think these are the debates we're gonna have. And I think this is what the FDA is debating sort of behind closed doors, my guess right now.
In the next segment, Dr. Kaklamani will discuss updates from the ELEVATE study.
Let me go over some of the ELEVATE data. And this, again, is the theme of oral SERDs here. And ELEVATE is a clinical trial that it is really a phase 1-2 study looking at dose-finding toxicities as well as some preliminary efficacy of combination therapies with elacestrant and pretty much everything else. So I won't go into the mechanism of action because I think we know it very well. Elacestrant is an oral SERD as well. It may be a little different from the other oral SERDs because it has some SERM efficacy as well. So it's maybe a half SERM, half SERD as compared to the other ones. But what I'll present today is the combination data with capivasertib. So before I do that, let me just go over the capivasertib data. And so this is from CAPItello-291. This is a clinical trial that looked at capivasertib plus fulvestrant versus standard of care. And the trial led to the approval of capivasertib. And the reason for that was the fact that capi was superior to the standard of care arm in patients that had tumors that had an alteration in the AKT PI3 kinase P10 pathway. So this is the updated results from CAPItello-291, which was the overall survival presented by Dr. Rugo at ESMO. And there's no difference in that overall survival, maybe even a flip. We didn't expect there to be an overall survival difference in this clinical trial, but there was a difference in progression-free survival. When looking at the pre-specified exploratory endpoint of overall survival in patients that had previously received the CDK4/6 inhibitor, here we actually do see a difference favoring capivasertib in the PIK3CA, AKT, P10 altered patient population compared to the overall patient population. What to make of these results, I don't really know. Again, it is pre-specified, but again, exploratory analysis of an otherwise negative endpoint. So moving on to ELEVATE. As I mentioned, ELEVATE is a trial that combines elacestrant with all three CDK4/6 inhibitors, alpelisib, everolimus, and most recently, capivasertib. So let's take a look at this patient population and the analysis presented at ASCO by Dr. Michalik. So this was actually a pretty interesting subset of patients and results because we're seeing now that the combination of elacestrant and capivasertib is giving us a median progression-free survival of 11.3 months. When looking at whether there is a difference between the patients that had ESR1 mutated tumors versus not, it doesn't look like there's a big difference. The median PFS in the ESR1 mutated tumors was 10.9 months. In the non-ESR1 tumors, it's just very few patients, only three patients. So the median PFS has not been reached. All patients on that trial had a PIK3CA mutated tumor. So this shows us that the combination is active and potentially more active than what we've seen with a non-oral SERD and capivasertib also, although this statement would not be statistically correct because this is a cross-trial comparison, which we don't like to do. This is the response rate from the elacestrant and capivasertib arm, and you can see here that most patients are having some sort of decrease in their their disease burden and a nice response rate of 33.3%. A median duration of response not reached yet. So I think, first of all, the important thing about this cohort is that we're now getting toxicity information. And if we ever wanted to combine capivasertib with elacestrant, we know what the right doses are, 345 and 320 milligrams. But also, we're getting some nice preliminary efficacy from this combination, which we may be able to use in the future when we want to try to combine these oral SERDs with other agents. So as a conclusion, again, this is a phase 1b/2 trial, so small trial, but it shows that there is an active combination of elacestrant and capivasertib, elacestrant with the dose of 345 milligrams daily, and capivasertib 320 milligrams twice daily, 4 days on and 3 days off. The treatment-related AEs were pretty low, which is important, and it showed us that there was a PFS of 11.3 months. Didn't really seem to make a huge difference whether there was coexistence of ESR1 or not, as long as the patients have PIK3CA mutated tumors, because that was one of the inclusion criteria for the clinical trial.
In the final segment, Dr. Wander will discuss updates from the VIKTORIA-1 study, followed by a review of the current and emerging treatment landscapes for patients with advanced hormone receptor-positive, HER2-negative, or low breast cancer.
Last but definitely not least, and this is for the VIKTORIA-1, but now the sub-study 2, which was just presented at SABCS at ASCO.
Great, thanks. Yep, so we'll end, and I have a slide at the end, trying to put it together and sort of saying where we're at right now for our evolving treatment landscape. Just to remind folks, and Kamal went over this nicely earlier, about the different oncogenic signaling pathways that influence endocrine and CDK4/6 resistance. On the right-hand side, we see that activated PI3 kinase signals through AKT and mTOR to do all kinds of bad things that the tumor cells need to grow and survive and divide and spread to other areas. We have everolimus, capivasertib, and the PI3K inhibitors, alpelisib and inavolisib. But just a reminder that gedatolisib is actually unique. It's a PI3K/AKT/mTOR inhibitor. It hits upstream and downstream. The trade-off here is that it's IV, 3 weeks on, 1 week off, because the oral formulations of the dual PI3K/mTOR inhibitors were just too toxic. With that in mind, we saw the Study 1 a few months back, last year at ESMO. This is patients who have progressed on a prior CDK4/6 inhibitor. They were allowed to have had 2 lines of endocrine therapy, no prior chemo, no prior mTOR, PI3K, or AKT inhibitors. They had to have an A1C that was below 6.4%, and we saw the wild-type data. So these patients had a mix of ESR1 mutant and wild-type, but no PIK3CA mutations, randomized to fulvestrant, geta, or the doublet with palbo, so triplet therapy, fulvestrant, geta, palbo. And just to remind us, when we saw that data, the doublet was 7 to 8 months, the triplet was 9 to 10 months, and the control arm was quite low at 2 months. So these are really nice hazard ratios on the order of 0.2 to 0.3. And this is really the first, in my opinion, mutation-agnostic data that we've really seen. I mean, maybe you could argue EMBER-3 in the kind of all-comer post-CDK also kind of hit numbers around 9 to 10 months. This is the first data outside of a CDK rechallenge, outside of a next-gen anti-estrogen, with no specific mutation requirement, posting kind of 9 to 10 months. And this is a table that we've used recently to show you the tox profiles of alpelisib, inavolisib, capivasertib, and gedatolisib. And I'm really just showing you all of the things that we care about in clinic, primarily hyperglycemia, diarrhea, mucositis, and rash, all grade and high grade. And for the geta, this is triplet therapy that I'm showing you here in the wild-type population. In gray, I'm showing you the winner, meaning the lowest rate. And you can see alpelisib didn't win any of them, but I'll come back to that point in a moment with the recent study, and that actually geta had the lowest rates of hyperglycemia and diarrhea, the trade-off being mostly low-grade stomatitis, about 70% all grade, 20% grade 3+. Now, what we saw at ASCO was the flip side. This is the same study population, but these patients had PIK3CA mutation, also a mix of ESR1, wild-type, and mutant, almost above 360 patients. But here they have a stronger control arm, fulvestrant alpelisib, so they're not going up against fulvestrant monotherapy in this PIK3CA mutant population. So you have the fulvestrant alpelisib control arm, fulvestrant get a doublet, and the triplet with palbo. And here are the top line results. Now notice, as we expect, the control arm is doing better at 5 to 6 months compared to the 2 month control arm in the other study. But now you actually see the triplet getting up to 11 plus months compared to 9 months in the wild type population. But to me, the big, I guess it, maybe the big surprise of this data was that the doublet and the triplet were really interchangeable. There was no additional benefit for adding palbociclib, where we saw a 2 to 3 month benefit in the PIK3CA wild type population for the triplet. The hazard ratios here are not quite as shocking because you had a stronger control arm, but they are statistically and clinically significant at about 0.5. And then here, the overall response rate was numerically a bit higher in the triplet. So even though the PFS was the same, it was about a 10 to 15% improvement in objective response rate. And the median duration of response, these are big confidence intervals here, but clearly were better with the geta than they were with alpelisib. Now, the tox wasn't much different. I'm not going to go much into this table except to show you study treatment discontinuation for adverse event. Look at the control arm on the order of sort of 7 to 10 months. That's much lower than we would expect from SOLAR-1 and even the BYLieve study that came a couple of years later. So that 5 to 6 month number on alpelisib is not due to high discontinuation rate. I think this is showing us what alpelisib is doing in the modern era, post 100% CDK, with good adaptation to the hyperglycemia and everything else, because we're not seeing as much discontinuation. I mean, don't get me wrong, we see all the hyperglycemia, but it's not catching us by surprise. We're intervening, we're controlling it, we're dose reducing, we're giving it, you know, diabetic medications, and the discontinuation here was historically low for alpelisib. So here are my thoughts on this. The geta doublet and triplet demonstrated significant PFS benefit compared to fulvestrant and alpelisib in the mutant group. Unlike the wild type, integrating the palbo did not prolong PFS in the same way that it did in the substudy one, but it did show an improvement in ORR. And so I would ask, what are the relevant mechanisms underlying the triplet benefit in the wild type that we don't see in the mutant? We can hypothesize a little bit, but this is going to be some very interesting molecular biomarker work to be done probably in the real world and like institutional setting once this data, once this drug gets out into practice. Toxicity data consistent with prior results, stomatitis being the main issue, discontinuation rates with alpelisib historically low. So I ask the question, will the geta-based doublet and triplet become a new second-line standard of care? And in whom? Who should we use this for? Can you salvage with geta, with a PAM inhibitor, if, for example, inovolisib is used in the first-line setting? So if you have INAVO120, or if INAVO123 is positive and we start using PI3K across the front line with either a first or new generation PI3K, can we overcome resistance with a PAM inhibitor acting downstream? Which ESR1 mutant patients should we give oral SERDs monotherapy versus geta in the second line? And which oral SERD doublets will emerge? Virginia just showed us some very encouraging numbers, right, with Capiva and elacestrant in the phase 1 coming into phase 2. So I keep changing this every like, you know, 20 to 30 days, but this is where I think we are today to close out. And we have 10 minutes, I think, for more discussion. Almost everybody's getting AI ribo in the front line. You're giving the INAVO120 triplet if they're endocrine refractory and PIK3CA mutant. In the second line, if they're PIK3CA, we could give alpelisib or capivasertib with fulvestrant, also true for the CAPI with AKT or P10. If they're ESR1 mutant, we now have 3 single agent next gen anti-estrogen drugs approved: elacestrant, imlunestrant, and the PROTAC, which we're waiting for distribution on, vepdegestrant. If they're BRCA, they can get PARP. If they're none of the above, we could give everolimus-based therapy. We could give abema, rechallenge, like postMONARCH. When we've exhausted all of that, we're going to give ADCs and chemo. Here are the phase 3 trials where we have data. So we have the camizestrant switch data that we already reviewed today, but no FDA approval yet in the 1.5 line. We have imlunestrant abema, which is hanging out there on the NCCN guidelines, but we don't have an FDA approval. And I would ask, if they were to approve it, would it be NGS agnostic or would it be ESR1 mutant? To me, the data looks pretty good sort of regardless of ESR1, but I think they're going kind of for an ESR1 subpopulation. Kamal showed us the giredestrant data, which if it gets approved, and I think it should based on the data, I think it would only be in the ESR1 mutant population based on that wild type analysis. And then we just talked about the geta doublets and triplets, which I think would be approved regardless of molecular genomic alterations, but I would think about only using the triplet really in the wild type or in a mutant population that I really need kind of a more robust response. And then we have these KAT6 inhibitors, new CDK4/2 inhibitors, RAS pathway inhibitors, kinase-specific PI3K inhibitors, new ADCs. So I'm going to need two slides or very small font pretty soon, I think, on this.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.